What was going through your mind when that woman shouted a word out and you went with it and sort of...
And I didn't. We were all just having fun. It was a great moment. I got a standing ovation. The place went wild. Somebody said mixed cheers. The place went wild.
No, I saw that.
Standing ovation. You know, you're talking about close to 5,000 people. Standing ovation went totally wild. And all I was doing is repeating because people couldn't hear it. So I was doing everybody a favor.
It is said when you see someone who looks like they don't feel very well, you say, my goodness, you look like death eating a cracker. Or if they look really bad, you say, you look like death eating a cracker walking backwards.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Welcome to the country of the free and the home of the slave, where the first man can only get elected by adult white males who own land. So everybody clap your hands as we open up the curtains on the hypocrisy of democracy in the republic where they only offer the limited few suffrage. In the time of George Washington, only 6% of the population could vote. It would take 100 years before all males gained the right to vote via the 18th Amendment, but apparently that was dependent on how white supremacists felt, and they didn't feel that way. So they started organizing themselves into clans with a K and coming up with new and more savage ways of intimidating black men from voting. Then the states chimed in, but they took the opposing view, like how you supposed to vote when you can't read, write, sign your name, or afford to pay a poll tax. So of course, in addition to blacks, a lot of impoverished and illiterate white people also got the axe. I guess you would call that collateral damage. And thank God for the advantages and strides made by people like Ida B. Wells, Emma Goldman, and Sarah Beeb. Because of them, women gained the right to vote in 1920. Then Native Americans gained the right to vote 4 years later. Way to go, America. Sometimes I feel like you compare us to some type of undemocratic democracy. And those tests and poll taxes would endure until the 24th Amendment in 1964. Then in 1965, they passed the Voters' Rights Act just to ensure that that 18th Amendment from a long, long time ago would finally have the teeth to be applied. Like they forgot we died. Like they forgot we fought in every war America ever had. Like they forgot that the first man who died in an American Revolution Crispus Attucks was black. And since we're discussing that, the 26th Amendment ensured that you were old enough to vote if you were old enough to go to war. Imagine being told that you were old enough to be deployed and bombed in Vietnam, but not old enough to vote for your leader. Then after that, they went back to standard procedure, business as usual, a bunch of think tanks and brain trusts sitting around conference tables trying to figure out what they could do to take away the rights that had already been given. Like taxation without representation had all of a sudden become the American tradition. What I mean? Oh, they gerrymander in the area that you live in, striking your name off the rolls if it too closely resembles someone who's been to felony prison. And if there's any question about your ballot, then your ballot was as good as missing. And they say in 2008, too many unlikely voters voted. And apparently in future elections, the key will be to make sure you show up with some form of government ID. The problem is 21 million potential voters don't have one. But remember, according to the Civil Rights Act of 1965, Section 5, your state needs Department of Justice approval before any new voting legislation goes live. Your state needs Department of Justice approval before any voting changes go live. So everybody, just put your hands to your chest and rise. God bless America. And I pray that one day we live up to the democratic ideals that we espouse. Live free or die.
Senator, one of the central points in your campaign, you say it over and over again, is that the American economic system is, in your words, rigged. But I want to go over some numbers with you. In 1981, the top 1% paid 17% of all income taxes. Now the top 1% pays 37%. Question, sir, if the wealthy have rigged the system, why have they done such a lousy job of it?
Oh, Chris, I think you are missing the major point here. And that is what we have seen in recent years is a huge transfer of wealth from the middle class to the top 1/10 of 1% whose percentage of wealth in America has doubled. We're talking about trillions of dollars going from the middle class to the top one-tenth of 1%.
But, sir, isn't a lot of that because of the economic policies of President Obama and of the Federal Reserve, which put interest rates at basically zero?
No, these are policies that have gone on for a long, long time under Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. Now, are we better off today than we were when President Bush left office and we were losing 800,000 jobs a month? Of course we are. But for the last 40 years, what we have been seeing is a middle class disappearing, people working longer hours for low wages, and today, as it happens, 58% of all new income is going to the top 1%. That's a rigged economy, to my mind, Chris.
In any way imply here that either President Obama or myself would in any way not take on any vested interest, whether it's Wall Street or drug companies or insurance companies or frankly the gun lobby, to stand up to do what's best for the American people.
Let's not insult the intelligence of the American people. People aren't dumb. Why in God's name does Wall Street make huge campaign contributions? I guess just for the fun of it. They want to throw money around.
Bernie Sanders going after Hillary Clinton's ties to Wall Street. Charlie Gasparino says these attacks could actually have an impact on the Clinton campaign. Think they're starting to chip away here a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, as freaky as Bernie Sanders is on so many levels, I mean, he's a hardcore socialist raising taxes to 90%. He's a freak to look at. His voice is annoying.
Welcome back to our special coverage tonight. As you have heard, Fox News has projected that Donald Trump has won the New Hampshire primary on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, could catch on in the summer months.
Spontaneous creatures ever created. stagnating wages in the middle, but you see that play out in different ways in both Trump's particularly closing message and railing against pharmaceutical companies and the like, and Bernie Sanders' message from the beginning. I just want to say, at least on behalf of me and my family, I thank God all the time that it was George W. Bush in the White House on 9/11 and not Al Gore. And I think you can look back in hindsight and say a couple things, but he kept us safe. And not only did he keep us safe, but no matter what you want to say about weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein was in violation of UN resolutions, an open violation, and the world wouldn't do anything about it. And George W. Bush, enforced with the international community, refused to do. And again, he kept us safe, and I am forever grateful to what he did for this
country. How did he keep us safe when the World Trade Center came down? The world, I lost hundreds of friends. The World Trade Center came down during the reign of George. He kept us safe. That's not safe. That is right. Not safe, Mark.
All right.
That is not safe.
The World Trade Center came down because Bill Clinton didn't kill Osama bin Laden when he had the chance to kill him.
And George Bush had the chance. By the way, George Bush had the chance also, and he didn't listen to the advice of his CIA.
All right, Dr. Carson, we have a... We have a cleansing.
I'm not going to invite Donald Trump to the rally in Charleston on Monday afternoon.
I don't want to go.
My brother's coming to speak.
Yeah.
I'm rescinding the invitation. I thought you might want to come, but I guess not.
His life, his policies have been very, very liberal. For most of his life, he has described himself as very pro-choice and as a supporter of partial birth abortion. Right now, today, as a candidate, he supports federal taxpayer funding for Planned Parenthood. I disagree with him on that. That's a matter of principle, and I'll tell you.
You are the single biggest liar. You probably are worse than Jeb Bush. You are the single biggest liar.
All right.
This guy lied. Let me just tell you. This guy lied about Ben Carson when he took votes away from Ben Carson in Iowa. And he just continues. And today we had robocalls saying Donald Trump is not going to run in South Carolina, where I'm leading by a lot. I'm not going to run. Vote for Ted Cruz. This is the same thing he did to Ben Carson. This guy will say anything. Nasty guy. Now I know why he doesn't have one endorsement from any of his colleagues.
All right, John, I
Senator Cruz, pick from the buffet there.
He's a nasty guy.
I'm
well,
next,
I will say,
well.
I will say it is fairly remarkable to see Donald defending Ben after he called him pathological and compared him to a child molester, both of which were offensive and wrong. But let me say more broadly, you notice Donald didn't disagree with the substance that he supports taxpayer funding for Planned Parenthood. And Donald has this weird pattern. When you point to his own record, he screams, liar, liar, liar. If you want to go...
Where did I support it? Where did I support it? Hey, Ted, where did I support it?
If you want to go and watch the video, go to our website, tedcruz.org.
Where did I support it, Ted?
Out of Donald's own mouth.
Where did I support it?
You supported it when we were battling over defunding Planned Parenthood. You went on television and said, Planned Parenthood does wonderful things, and we should not defund
it. Well, it does do wonderful things, but not as it relates to abortion.
So tell me, what are the wonderful things it does?
There are wonderful things having to do with women's health.
You see, you and I disagree on that.
Not when it comes to abortion. That's where I draw the line.
John, the reason principle matters. The reason principle matters, sadly, was illustrated by the first questions today. The next president is going to appoint 1, 2, 3, 4 Supreme Court justices. John. If Donald Trump is president, he will appoint liberals. If Donald Trump is president, your Second Amendment will go away.
Hold on, LaVar. You know how I know that? Hold on, gentlemen. I'm going to turn this car around.
Because then the Republicans laid out a banquet of all-you-can-eat crazy. Last week, after Iowans wished 12 candidates into the cornfield, one was left standing in triumph.
Tonight, the state of Iowa has spoken. To God be the glory.
Oh, hi. I'll finish this later. Okay, so Iowans chose fist-faced horse salesman Ted Cruz as their new prize heifer. Now, normally, the winner gets an Iowa bump, and no, that does not mean doing a hit of cocaine in the Pizza Ranch toilets. Just how big was Cruz's bump heading into New Hampshire?
Ted Cruz, who won Iowa, is in fifth place.
Gee, I wonder why. Could it be this?
Your husband is sort of actively disliked by a lot of his colleagues in the Senate, Republican colleagues in the Senate. But you chose to spend your life with him. When you hear these kinds of things said about your husband, that he's just not likable, that he's insufferable, I mean, you've heard them all. Is it a punch in the gut or in the heart?
It's not his fault, Dana. My husband has stage 4 cancer of the personality. Now look, I dislike Ted Cruz as much as the next everyone. But that's no reason to be rude to Ted's loving wife and possible hostage. Cruz's Iowa bump was snatched by Marco Rubio, third in Iowa, second in New Hampshire, first to exploit his kids for a photo op.
Are you hot? Huh? Would you like some water? I want some water.
Oh, look at that. Marco Rubio has finally found a way to look like the big boy in the room. Hey, you know what? Ted Cruz has somehow managed to reproduce. Maybe he can use his child to make him seem more personable.
Let's hop out of my
screen.
Good job. Maybe she just needs to get to know him. Could anything be more awkward? Turns out, yes. Saturday's Republican debate went off the rails at about the -1 minute mark when 43% of Republican candidates failed the important presidential test. Can you walk successfully to a podium? A task routinely mastered by laboratory mice and frightened 4-year-olds on toddlers and tiaras.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Republican candidates.
There's 3 empty podiums. Look, even if one's for Elijah, there's still 2 empty podiums. And that was just the first domino in a cascade of fail. Sentient caps lock button Donald Trump forgot to bring his nouns to the debate.
Tremendous has been just sucked out of our country by China. We have to have a temporary something because there's something going on that's not good.
Tremendous something front runner good not suck. And Rubio, oh, Rubio, he showed up at the debate all but wearing his likely nominee crown, and it took Chris Christie 10 seconds to crush him like a bug.
You have not been involved in a consequential decision where you had to be held accountable. You just simply haven't. That's not leadership, that's truancy.
Let's dispel with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing.
That's what Washington, D.C. does. The memorized 25-second speech, that is exactly what his advisors gave him.
This notion that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing is just not
there true. There it is.
Whoops. That was a bit painful. Can we just watch the quicker version? Oh, I bet that Rubio wishes he left his kids at home tonight.
Let's dispel with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing.
Oh, guys, cheer up. Daddy's coming home soon. It's okay. Okay, Marco, you're rattled. Just keep your head down and oh, no. Oh, my God. No, he's talking again. Oh, no.
Why doesn't the media ask Hillary Clinton why she believes that all abortion should be legal, even on the due date of that unborn child?
Okay, that is literally the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Removing a baby on the due date isn't an abortion. It's called a cesarean. But you know what? That's fine. Keep telling your cabal of fetus fanatics that Hillary Clinton wants us to carry to term and then deliver our babies directly into a Vitamix so that Planned Parenthood can sell it to Whole Foods.
I would rather lose an election than be wrong on the issue of life.
Congratulations. Tonight you did both. Bye-bye.
Where the moon, where the dust, there's a promise you can't. Still broken.
That's chapter one. Would you like to have chapter two? You better, son of a bitch. I know the way.
At issue, the song of the president, 1968. Can a president really be made by manipulating the mass media, particularly the strongest medium of them all, television? I am Denny Crimmins, associate publisher of Harper's Magazine. And with me today on At Issue is Joe McGinnis, contributor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Song of the President, 1968, which has become the nation's number one bestseller. Joe, we were talking prior to the program about how you got involved in your first sort of contacts with this sort of this new media barony that surrounds presidential candidates. Do you want to start there? Would you like to get into the heat of how you really make a candidate through television?
Well, I can start there and try to get through that background as briefly as possible. I had been doing the column in Philadelphia for about 2 years, and the Inquirer, the paper I did it for, was owned by Walter Annenberg, who, after Nixon was elected, was named ambassador to England. So it developed that my political sympathies and Mr. Annenberg's were frequently at odds, and this grew to be more of a problem as 1968 progressed, the political year, the presidential election year. And during the year, I had gotten, not intimate, but close enough to Robert Kennedy to really care when he was killed. And a column that I wrote right after that assassination from Los Angeles, in which I said America was no longer a country, but a cesspool, so enraged the publisher, Mr. Annenberg, that he felt compelled to 4 or 5 days later write an editorial in which he, I think immature was about the nicest word he used to describe me, and said that the Inquirer as a paper vigorously condemned my vile blasphemy of America. And I thought that over for a couple of days and just decided that I didn't want to work anymore for a man who could be so much more incensed by a column than he could by the assassination itself. So I took a week off to think things over, came up to New York and wrote a magazine story for TV Guide on Howard Cosell, the sportscaster. And while going from Cosell's home one morning to the railroad station with him, we were riding in a car with a man who was the executive vice president of Doyle Dane Birnbeck.
New York Advertising Agency.
And this fellow told Cosell and myself that just the day before, Doyle Dane had accepted the Hubert Humphrey account. And I told him that seemed like kind of a difficult thing to sell, even tougher than Volkswagens or Avis, with which Doyle Dane had made its name.
You're only number two with Avis, yeah. But with
with Humphrey at that time, you were about number eight. However, Russell, who was his name was Ed Russell, he said, "Oh, you don't understand." He said, "Right now, to you, he seems like Hubert Humphrey, but by November, by God, he'll be Abraham Lincoln." And that really got me thinking. Could they really do it this way? Could a Madison Avenue agency come in, take a man, and sell him like a can of peas or an automobile? That possibility seemed intriguing enough to make me decide to leave the Inquirer and to do a book about it, basing it on the 1968 election.
You covered both candidates.
I covered both candidates. In fact, I got into it through Humphrey. I didn't know anyone at Nixon's headquarters. I didn't even know very many Republicans. I had to call Nixon's people blind. I found them surprisingly cooperative. As long as I agreed not to print anything before the election, they agreed to let me have complete access to their meetings, to their files, and to all the people involved in the image campaign.
From your piece on Harper's, you really got behind the scenes. I mean, the staging of how the panelists were selected, how the thing was staged, who the claques were, and how the claques were recruited.
I just about lived with these people from June through election night, literally 7 days a week, every week in that period, with the three or four people who were most responsible for the advertising of Richard Nixon, for the selling of Richard Nixon.
Would you take one of those typical programs you describe in your piece and sort of describe it to the listening audience?
Well, there were two main thrusts that the advertising took. There were, first of all, the live panel shows in which Nixon went from state to state and appeared on live television for 60 minutes, paid for time paid for just like regular advertising time is bought, and answered the questions of a panel of, quote, representative, unquote, citizens in the area. For example, in Pennsylvania, they did a show in Philadelphia where Nixon talked to 7 or 8 different people for an hour. The people were recruited by the Nixon organization, and even though their questions were legitimately new questions, it was not rehearsed. Nixon didn't know exactly what question was coming, but from having done 1 or 2 and from knowing the kind of people who were selected, who were for the most part good, loyal Republicans with an occasional House Negro thrown in or a House Liberal who they knew wouldn't be too offensive or too penetrating, it was really a setup. It gave the appearance of being live. It gave the appearance of Nixon taking risks without actually taking any at all. Well, this was one, and this is one half of the thing. The other half was a series of 60-second spot commercials, which were produced by a man named Eugene Jones, who's a filmmaker, a very, very good filmmaker, too. Here, Nixon's words, mostly the same old tired words of the acceptance speech, would be played in accompaniment to a series of still photographs that were being flashed in rapid succession across the screen, so that you might, in 60 seconds, get 40 or 50 different colored photographs.
Counterpoint to the words,
so that the same tired words could, through this very sophisticated use of a multimedia technique, sink in quite deeply into a person's, not just to his consciousness, but to his subconsciousness.
Well, I remember very clearly the one you describe in your piece is that panning back from a helmet in Vietnam. It's
right.
Love on the front of the helmet, which is, I think, was the concluding shot of his.
This was the concluding shot. Nixon, of course, had been saying really not too much about Vietnam. They took a few of the old tape recordings and spliced them together, where Nixon was saying that we've got to, you know, new leadership will bring an end to this war, an honorable end to the war in Vietnam, avoid the mistakes of the past 4 years. While he was saying this, however, a series of dramatic pictures would be flashed across the screen, and the last one was of a completely tired and exhausted and beaten down soldier leaning against a bunker in Vietnam with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, wearing a helmet on which the word love was inscribed, and slowly the camera came in tighter and tighter and tighter until the final shot was just a forehead and helmet, an eye close-up, which contained the word love in the big letters. And interestingly enough, there's a little postscript to that. This was this particular spot and this particular use of the word love in a soldier's helmet so enraged Midwestern congressmen by, in their eyes, it equated soldiers with hippies. You know, love to them was a dirty word. In 1968, to a lot of Republicans, love was a dirty word. It was associated with hippies and anti-establishment demonstrations. And a number of congressmen from the Midwest called Nixon's advertising people and said, this just won't do. This is going to hurt him out here. Their kind of soldiers, the Midwestern kind of soldiers, not the kind who wears love in his helmet. He wears kill or, you know, God bless America, but certainly not love. So under pressure of this sort, that particular photograph was removed from later versions of
right.
that 60-second commercial. Right.
Again, let's go back to this particular image of Nixon. You know, from Hubert Horatio Humphrey to Abe Lincoln is one transition. But the lighting from the 5 o'clock shadow Nixon we knew in the Nixon-Kennedy debates of his past trip to
same
race.
There was none of that here, although actually things like that, those physical problems are about the easiest to overcome. Those are just really minor technical points which any good makeup man can overcome. The concept of creating a whole new Nixon, or first of all, of just destroying the old Nixon, because this was really what their job was with Nixon. There was a stereotype firmly implanted in the minds of most Americans of Richard Nixon, and it was not a stereotype which would cause them to vote for him for president. So that the first job that Nixon's advertising people had was to erase this old image, and they set about taking great pains as early as the fall of 1966 to slowly and carefully, with very subtle strokes, erase this old image.
How? By getting him around from the other side of the desk? Leaving him unprotected in front of the television cameras?
That's a good example. By making him appear... The best way that it was put by one of Nixon's staff people, that we have to make it seem that in addition to all his other attributes, Richard Nixon really considers communicating with the people of America to be one of the great joys in life. And if there's anything that's true of Richard Nixon, of course, is that he does not consider communicating with the people of America a great joy in life. You know, he much prefers the isolation of the White House. This is why he's so happy as president, is that he is legitimately cut off from the people. He doesn't have to get out there and mix it up with a man in the street whose instincts he shares, but whose company he doesn't really relish. So they had to make him appear warmer, more human. They had to give him a sense of humor. And the sense of humor was acquired through high-paid gag writers. One of the early notations made by Nixon's creative director of advertising was that he needs humor, but here we have to be very careful because Romney's cornball attempts have hurt him more than helped him. And his precise phrase, in fact, which he concluded in the piece, is if we're going to be witty, let a pro write the words.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a keynote.
It
of
couldn't
the whole
be a sort of the press conference Kennedy style of witty.
No, it
had
couldn't
to be something counterpoint to that even.
Right.
I know. So also in here, you talk about the rest of the family in the act. Also, very sort of I forget what you called them, the Nixon chorus or the
Glee Club.
The Glee Club. That's
one
what
of the assistants called them. This was another part of the attempt to humanize him. Don't show him only with a briefcase in his hand. Occasionally, try to present him in warm human situations, with his arm around his wife or kissing his daughter on the cheek. It wasn't the kind of thing that was natural to him. But to a certain extent, he agreed to consciously try to act as if he were a little more in love, simply to make himself appear more as a human being.
You seem to indicate also that there's some work done on Mrs. Nixon, and sort of a softening of her image vis-a-vis the female voter.
There was an attempt at this, but she was quite difficult to work with, and the final compromise that was made, I think, was just keeping her out of the picture as much as possible. She would appear for each panel show, and there would be an introduction of her and whichever daughter happened to be with her at the time in the beginning. But there would, except for the telethon the last night of the campaign, there would be no real direct contact with her during these shows. She was there, she was a fixture, but in the end she became little more than an ornament.
This is kind of a counterpoint to her predecessor.
It was
omnipresent in almost everything.
Sure.
You know, the thing that in reading your piece, when you really start to think about it, is the measure and the power of the manipulation of this particular medium.
Right. These guys are just too good for us. There is no defense against it because we just don't know at the time what's being done. There are probably very few people in America who were not involved who got to see it the way I did. And certainly if you're just home as a television viewer seeing this stuff come to you in its final form every night, you really don't have a defense. There's no way you can guard against it.
Do you think there ought to be any kind of legislation or any sort of code of ethics or some way of controlling this?
Well, there already is some legislation involving the use to which a president or the executive department of the federal government can put television. For example, a president is not allowed to use any visual aids when he's making a speech on television to the country. All he can do is stand there and speak. He can't use charts and slides and graphs.
Or cut away to the photographs we talked about earlier.
Or if he's talking about poverty, he can't come up with a little film sequence of showing poor people. Now, perhaps this kind of a thing is going to have to be extended to advertising in a campaign for the presidency, because the way it went in 1968, really, it was not a battle between the two men. It was a battle between the image makers on either side.
The opposing image makers were fighting it out with scissors and film and lighting techniques.
Right, and the candidates themselves really were little more than pawns on the board.
Well, you know, this sort of, is this now being applied to local candidates? Has everybody kind of learned a lesson from the selling of a president?
Well, it has been, and in fact, I think to some extent Nixon learned a lesson from the selling of some local candidates. I mean, John Lindsay was not exactly naive in this area in his first campaign.
Governor Rockefeller.
Nor Governor Rockefeller, nor Ronald Reagan, of course, nor Percy, nor almost any young and personable candidate. The interesting thing about this is that Nixon was neither young nor personable. And this demonstrated that these same techniques can work not with only with a man.
You don't have to be a George Murphy or a Reagan or a television star.
You don't have
to
have the charisma. They can give it to you no matter who you are.
Thank you, Joe McGinnis.
Thank you, Denny.
We've taken a close look at how television can sell a presidency.
Medium is the message, means that the medium is the thing which is making the difference. In every discussion you ever hear since the 60s about TV, for example, is it good, is it bad, terrible, wonderful, the discussion hinges around what's on TV. And people say, well, television is terrible, it just shows violence. And then somebody else says, no, television is wonderful, those nature shows and news from far away and masterpiece theater. This is a stupid argument. What McLuhan meant by the media is the message is he meant that it doesn't matter what you put on TV. TV is TV. It has an intrinsic nature. And whether you're showing National Geographic specials or slasher movies, TV will do what it does. It has certain qualities, just like driving a car or skiing. Certain muscles are going to be exercised, certain perceptual systems enhanced, others suppressed. And it's very hard for us to understand this because we have accepted this media so thoroughly into our life. But in fact, it is shaping our value systems in ways that are very hard for us to suspect or even even detect. I mean, television, for example, it's a drug. It has a series of measurable physiological parameters that are as intrinsically its signature as the parameters of heroin are its signature. I mean, you sit somebody down in front of a TV set and turn it on, 20 minutes later come back, sample their blood pressure, their eye movement rate, blood is pooling in their rear end, their breathing takes on a certain quality, the stare reflex sets in. I mean, they are thoroughly zoned on a drug. And when you think about the fact that the average American watches 6.5 hours of television a day, imagine if a drug had been introduced in 1948 that we all spent 6.5 hours per day on average watching. And the one thing about drugs in their defense is that it's very hard to diddle the message. A drug is a mirror. But television isn't a mirror. Television is a billboard, and anybody who pays their money can put their message into the trip. This is an extraordinarily insidious situation. What McLuhan wanted to become, I think, was the founder of a general new sophistication about media. And he was essentially parodied to get to death by, guess what? Media. They made of him an icon of cultural incomprehensibility. Not since Einstein have you been so pre-programmed in advance to believe you ain't gonna understand this guy. And that's what they said about McLuhan, and consequently, his message and his insight failed. We will have to reinvent McLuhan around the turn of the century because we are producing forms of media of such interactive power and potential social impact that we're going to have to go back and rethink all of this.
Come on, man, just watch me. Watch and listen.
Pictures worth a thousand words, I'll paint a thousand pictures. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I'll paint a thousand pictures. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I'll paint a thousand pictures. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I'll paint a thousand pictures. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I'll paint a thousand pictures. To symbolize the decibel levels, bread of a thousand whispers. To mummify useless unknown poems, spit a shower with gold glitter. Pressure increase, unleash the catacomb splitters. For some reason you wonder why your puzzle is a jigsaw. When you fail to decipher the Morse code, to simply avoid the pitfalls. If need be I can get raw, just pocket the latex. But that's like asking why the man with no legs crawls to see the apex. Or why the unplanted seeds won't blossom into a garden. Parallel to your search for stardom when you leave breadcrumbs and jargon that you can't even feel. So how's that for surface tension? Every step shows you a worthless henchman itching to meet your maker. I'd rather finger paint than take a tainted pen and curse the paper. Voice box turns cauldron, saliva boils, then thoughts of vapor. See a foremost only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. Then a thoroughbred's accuracy isn't the focal point of perfection. Therefore, you trudge through waist-high sludge and caramelized paints where prints left taint every breath in hell. Hold in oxygen, then step graciously over landmines shallow beneath the soil surface. Take a small step for man and ascend the stairway to heaven on pegs. Or take a giant leap for mankind to stand and keep your legs. What a dilemma to hold hands with. Sanity's a steep cliff of gift, and it seems because of your forked tongue dreams your hand slipped.
Grip your canteen of get-rich schemes and set sail on the seven seas. Hooker left that envy to drown in greed before you swallow your pride and wash it down with a glass of formaldehyde. I'll preserve the day the earth fell to symbolize how Atlas died. I'll try to rush the wormhole to deliver a eulogy, but the other eight planets followed me to stage a silent mutiny.
No more
dodging shooting stars,
no more
lashing of asteroid
no
belts,
more
avoiding supernovas in fear of android wealth. If science and religion is the building block for a laughing stock, then the foundation should crumble at the epicenter of the aftershocks. The valve breaks at the vinyl spots, the crater will fall as crime rate drops. I've timed hate crops harvest to see if records of frisbees fly
well,
for
that
harvest.
Would depend on the trajectory
and the way the projector projected me. I was a hologram waiting for wind to inherit merit discrepancy.
Is it time for liftoff?
I think Go-Go Gadget propellers are prepared.
Is it time for liftoff?
The rocket fuel was at peak in midweek.
I think it's time for liftoff.
The structural integrity seems to be holding, but three astronauts were found in a cockpit falling asleep. So will these thousand whispers ever hold a clef note to sing? Or will these blisters become targets of the Scorpion King's sting? Because the poison invades the veins till the stage is immune. I'll take a rain check in the same breath of a checkmate. In three moves, I know everything is everything and nothing still something else. So I cleared my shelves of any signs of wealth to impress the elves. My neck, it holds bricks that weighs down my lift off. As a precaution, I've replaced the wood in the loft with something soft. Your windows, they look clear, but my panes are stained glass to dampen the impression of expression any fame has. Do the hues you use, do they capture the pain my frame has? Or are you caught in the faces we weave, scared to change masks? I'm the lawnmower man on a mission to slaughter the strange grass, but first I must erase cyberspace and rape the track before a train pass. You strain cash while I take the root of evil, make tea, patiently holding hands with anxiousness.
I can already taste
that's the kettle whistle interrupting my vision of rainbow bands. The steam scolding my hand, the mug shattered and I wasted it. Now if a picture's worth a thousand words, I painted a thousand pictures on a beautiful backdrop of butterfly kisses. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I painted a thousand pictures. If a scream is worth a thousand dreams, I've dreamed a thousand whispers. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I painted a thousand pictures. If a scream is worth a thousand dreams, I've dreamed a thousand whispers. If a picture's worth a thousand words, I painted a thousand pictures. If a scream is worth a thousand dreams, I've dreamed a thousand whispers. I screamed a thousand whispers.
I wanted to quickly throw together a series of short videos addressing some of the statist absurdities that are out there. I'm talking about ideas and terms that are all over the place. You'll hear them mentioned constantly in the media, you'll hear politicians using them. You've probably even used them yourself. And these ideas, despite the fact that they're all over the place, they bear no resemblance to reality. They're utterly absurd. And I'll do these in no particular order, but we'll start with the concept of public servants. In the media, you'll constantly hear politicians, federal, state, local, it doesn't matter. You'll constantly hear legislators referred to as public servants, as if they're out there doing the work of the people and serving us, and so on and so forth. Now, this particular lie has been unraveling for a while, because there are so many examples demonstrating that the politicians aren't doing what they do for us. They don't care what we want. They don't care what we think. When they go out there and raise taxes while people are saying, we're taxed enough already, we can't handle it, politicians say, we don't care, we're raising them again. When they go out and they do their warmongering, and most of the country says, we don't like that, we don't want that, politicians say, we don't care. They try to nationalize the healthcare industry, when most of the people say, we don't want you to do that. They do it anyway. One of the most ridiculous examples, bailouts, where they steal gazillions of dollars from you and me and all the normal people and give huge piles of money to gigantic corporations and gigantic international banks and basically all the politicians' rich buddies. The notion that they're doing that for our benefit is just ridiculous. But even without all those examples, even without being able to show, look at all these ways in which the politicians obviously don't care what we think. Even without them, the concept of public servants, the concept itself is inherently bogus. And you can understand that as soon as you understand what the terms even mean. You talk about politicians as public servants. Well, what are politicians? What do they do? What do legislators do? Well, they legislate. That's why they're called legislators. But what does that mean? Well, they write laws. Well, what's a law? Well, they get together and they scribble down a whole bunch of words on paper. And it may be a gazillion pages long and convoluted, confusing terminology, but the template is always the same. Every law either is telling the rest of us, you must do this, or you may not do that. And if we catch you disobeying us, we will send men with guns to hurt you, to take your property, or to put you in a cage. That's all the law is. That's all the law ever is. Every law is a threat of violence, usually against you. They're threatening you with violence if you don't obey whatever commands they come up with this week. And sometimes they try to hide that reality under layers of euphemism and propaganda. And so some people will say, well, they don't just threaten people. The government gives to the poor. No, they don't. Government produces nothing of value. It produces no wealth. They don't give to the poor. They use threats of violence to make you give to the poor. They say, we're going to tax you, and we're going to put you in a cage if you resist, and then we're going to take your money and give it to the poor, and then we're going to say, look how charitable and compassionate we are. They don't give to the poor. They use the threat of violence to make you and me give to the poor. And that's what every law is. That's what every law is a threat of violence. Now, if you have one group of people that issues threats of violence against another group, this group is not serving this group. The notion that they're forcibly dominating this group to serve it and for its benefit, for its own good, it's just ridiculous. You know, if you accept that the people who do that are public servants, then I'd like to volunteer to be your servant. So what I'm going to do is boss you around and tell you what to do, tell you what you can do, tell you what you're not allowed to do, tell you how you have to behave, tell you what choices you have to make, and take a whole bunch of your money, and send armed thugs to hurt you if you disobey me. If I did that, you wouldn't call it serving you. When they do it, all the media says they're serving us, they're public servants. It's completely ridiculous. Let me put this in the simplest possible terms. If somebody bosses you around and takes your money, he's not your servant. If he doesn't boss you around and take your money, he's not government. That's what government is. It's a ruling class that coercively dominates everyone else. That's what they are. They can't be a servant.
Conspiracy theory is a kind of epistemological cartoon about reality. I mean, isn't it so simple to believe that things are run by the Greys and that all we have to do is trade sufficient fetal tissue to them and we can solve our technological problems? Or isn't it comforting to believe that the Jews are behind everything, or the Communist Party, or the Catholic Church, or the Masons? Well, these are epistemological cartoons. It's, kindergarten stuff in the art of amateur historiography. I believe that the truth of the matter is far more terrifying, that the real truth that dare not speak itself is that no one is in control. Absolutely no one You know, you don't understand Monica, you don't understand Netanyahu. It's because nobody is in control. This stuff is ruled by the equations of dynamics and chaos. Now, there may be entities seeking control, the World Bank, the Communist Party, the rich, the somebody others, but to seek control is to take enormous aggravation upon yourself. Because this process that is underway will take the control freak by the short and curly and throw them against the wall.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
Sometimes I wish we could say what we mean. Instead of binding our hands, trying to swim upstream. Then the way could be easy. All the road wouldn't seem so rough. You could say you had reasons. Be enough. Sometimes the lights will play tricks with your eyes, casting shadows more than twice the size. Makes the night seem so scary.
GoFindTheOthers.com.
We, the people, chose to do these things together because we know this country cannot accomplish great things if we pursue nothing greater than our own individual ambition. Unfortunately, you've grown up hearing voices that incessantly warn of government as nothing more than some separate, sinister entity that's at the root of all our problems. Some of these same voices also do their best to gum up the works. They'll warn that tyranny is always lurking just around the corner. You should reject these voices.